Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things everyone's passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics.
And today we're aiming at Darwin Day, February 12th. Darwin Day promotes the public education about science and encourages the celebration of science and humanity. And we need a little celebration because sometimes the dialogue can get a little heated, as we've noticed here in Texas lately, as the School Board of Education has been discussing new guidelines for the science curriculum and is moving toward excising the language that discusses the strengths and weaknesses of Darwinian evolution from the required curriculum in Texas public schools. And this has elicited a great debate around the big question that we often feature on The Things That Matter Most, which is, where did we come from? And the answer is so important to understand, who are we? What makes us flourish? How do we find purpose and meaning? Where are we going? To our Darwin Day question now, who are we? We live in a time with increasingly polarizing answers, and distinguished voices in science ferociously contend that in the beginning were the particles on one hand, and their chance combinations and recombinations just produced the universe and all the great diversity of life we see today. And equally passionate in their reply, distinguished voices in theology and science defend the scriptural record. In the beginning was the Word who created and cares for his creation. And they're joined by many scientists who may not start with scripture, but who may not even believe in the God of the Bible, but they are also convinced that the extraordinary complexity of the universe and life in particular point to an intelligence behind it all. So to celebrate how science informs our answers to the questions of where did we come from and who are we, we've invited two of those distinguished voices in this lively debate to a discussion of each other's books, and we're so honored that they've agreed to join us. Dr. Carl Giverson teaches physics at Eastern Nazarene College and is director of the Forum on Faith and Science at Gordon College. And our focus today will be on his book, brand new, Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. And next week, we'll focus on a new textbook for intelligent design, exploring evolution with one of its co-authors, Dr. Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson teaches at Biola University and is a fellow with Discovery Institute. Both of them have very distinguished PhDs, Giverson from Rice, Nelson from the University of Chicago, and they bring a wealth of expertise and knowledge to this discussion. Next week, Dr. Giverson will be on hand as we discuss Dr. Nelson's book, Exploring Evolution, a new supplementary textbook that teaches the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. So each one will make their case, and each one will have an opportunity to respond to the other's book. Carl Giverson, we start with you and your book on Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. In a nut, just like the elevator pitch here, why do you think a Christian can believe in evolution?
Well, I think it's entirely possible to view the unfolding patterns of nature as God's creative work. I think the sciences point very clearly to there being developmental processes at work in the world. And as Christians, I don't see any reason why we can't suppose that God, who has a kind of a bird's eye view of all of history at once, can't be working through processes that look developmental to us.
Okay. And you began college, you write in this book, as a devout Christian and a fierce creationist. But then the more you studied science, the more questions you had. How did you personally make peace with evolution and also continue in your Christian faith?
Well, I became convinced that the particular way that I had been encouraged to read Genesis and the rest of the scriptures was artificial, that a set of questions that were kind of 20th century scientific concerns were being read back into the Genesis story, as if somehow the writers of Genesis were thinking about questions like the age of the universe and the structure of the cosmos and genetics and so on. And the more I learned about scripture and about science, the more I realized how radically different the modern scientific worldview is than the ancient Hebrew worldview, and how we really shouldn't be taking our 20th century questions back to the centuries before Christ and expecting somehow that the ancient Hebrews were asking and answering these same kinds of questions. And so as I kind of began to disconnect the science that I was learning from the scriptures that I had kind of been raised on as a kid.
Well, we describe our show as a show where we talk about things that people are way more passionate about than even sports or politics. And I so appreciated how you documented in your book the intensity of this controversy between Darwinian evolution on the one hand and then creation and intelligent design on the other. And so maybe you could tell our audience, why do you think that this controversy has become so bitter? Why have the headlines in Texas recently been filled with reports of these very passionate testimonials and appeals in front of our State Board of Education about how to teach it in our public schools?
Well, it's because the controversy over creation evolution has become very much a proxy war. It's like all those wars that the United States fought against the Soviet Union during the Cold War, where some little tiny episode somewhere would have two superpowers kind of engaged in it, and everybody knew that the real war was about communism and not about whatever was the local conflict there. In the same way, creation evolution has become a proxy war today for belief in God, and evolution is presented by some of its most articulate spokespersons as being a way to free ourselves from any need to think about God at all. And this is offensive to religious people, and so they're fighting against that, not because they really care about the details of speciation or how old the earth is, but because they're being led to believe, both by Christians who oppose evolution and pundits like Richard Dawkins who promote it, that this is a way to get God out of the picture, and they'd rather have God in the picture than evolutionary science, and because they're confused about that, they fight with great vigor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you think, you write, one of the things I really appreciated about your book, obviously you're presenting a particular point of view that you can be a Christian and believe in evolution, but more than that, you're documenting really what you think have been strategic errors of both sides. You're documenting even how you think that both sides have, you know, may not have been fair in their presentation of the evidence and the extrapolation of that evidence. So how do you think Darwinian evidence have maybe not come clean and been absolutely fair and forthcoming about the evidences and the truth of what they know and how they apply it in this public controversy? Maybe you could just give one or two big examples quickly.
Well, I would give two examples. I would say that I don't think that people that promote evolution are very honest about how it's been used in the past. And evolution has been used in the past to make arguments about eugenics and improving the species by forcibly sterilizing people that were thought to be inferior. And in the early part of the 20th century, the United States had eugenics offices set up in most states, and tens of thousands of women were sterilized against their will because the scientific consensus was that this was good for the species, and this had come out of Darwinian reasoning, and while we've rejected that today, it still was so intimately connected with Darwin's thinking at the time that I think it's disingenuous to kind of pretend that it was some kind of an aberration. See it in the textbooks and so on from that time period. So I think there's a sense in which people are not being honest about the past there. And so when you're not honest and you get exposed, as people have been, it seems like you're hiding something, and that makes people uneasy. But I also think that evolution is being misrepresented in the present. It's often described as if it's like just another theory like any other theory in science, and you'll see some comparison between evolution and Einstein's theory of relativity, and they'll say Einstein's theory of relativity can be taught without disclaimers and without controversy, so why do we have all this controversy surrounding evolution? Well, I mean, evolution is nothing like relativity. They are radically different theories. Relativity is a simple, clean theory with a small set of very compelling evidences that that support it, and so on. And I mean, evolution is a big, sprawling, messy theory that relates huge disciplines within the field of biology to each other, and it doesn't have a few compelling whiz-bang things that you can point to that confirm it. It has instead a whole mountain of little tiny things that you have to kind of add them all up and say, well, there is a mountain of evidence for evolution. But each one of the individual pieces is quite small, and there are a lot of counter-evidences and so on. So I think to represent evolution as if it's a simple, straightforward scientific theory like quantum theory or atomic theory or relativity theory is to misrepresent it. And I think any time you are not honest about what you are promoting, you make people suspicious when they find that out. And I think people are rightly suspicious when they read these descriptions of evolution.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, in President Bush's No Child Left Behind legislation, Rick Santorum submitted an amendment that called for teaching the controversy. And the context of this was that the National Association of Biology Teachers or something said, you know, don't single out evolution as a controversial theory because it's no more controversial than the theory of relativity. Was that, am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah, and so then when people find out, well, no, from scientific perspective, there's this huge distinction between the sprawling and, as you say, messy and not so easily falsifiable claims of relativity of Darwinian evolution as opposed to the more simply elegant claim and smaller claim of relativity. When they find out that that has been sort of mismatched in the comparison, then immediately the red flag goes up. Well, moving on, what do you think, where are some ways that you think maybe intelligent design scientists have not been as forthcoming about the truth as you would think would be fair and honest?
Well, I think that intelligent design has been around long enough now that it kind of goes back to Philip Johnson getting started in the kind of the early 90s and so on. I mean, there were predictions made in the 90s that, like, within a decade, Darwinism was going to crumble and it's a tottering theory and so on. And readers and enthusiasts of intelligent design were kind of led to believe that we're on the brink of some sort of a big revolution where Darwinism is just going to collapse. But yet the people who were inside the field of biology had no sense of this whatsoever, that Darwinism was about to collapse. And mm-hmm. I think the way that the intelligent design movement established its foothold by highlighting a few gaps in scientific knowledge that couldn't be explained thoroughly by evolution and saying that these will never be explained by evolution, and then watching those gaps close and so on has been a public relations problem for ID. But I think that ID unfortunately got caught up in politics, I think, and lost sight of the science along the way, that people were writing books for lay audiences that were doing quite well, and this was, of course, much easier than trying to do scientific research. And in a somewhat damning interview, William Dembski even admitted that it's easier to write popular books than to do research, and you get more royalties off of it, and so on. And so ID never really tried to do what it said it was doing, which was develop a new research paradigm that would show that that directed intelligence was discernible in the natural order. And so now, you know, several years after these early promises were made, they've kind of come up dry. And I think that ID is kind of on the decline now. I think we can see this a little bit in the new book that Stephen Meyer has coming out this year, where it appears that ID has now been sort of restricted a little bit to the origin of life, and some of these other examples are no longer being promoted as exemplary of the ID paradigm. I mean, Paul might know more about that than I do. But
yeah, I was just going to ask. I was just going to ask Paul. You know, although I would respond, Carl, that it does sound like we're really seeing a little bit of apples and oranges here. You're looking at the Darwinian scientists who are literally shading the truth of what they're putting out there as evidence, while you're saying that the ID people have made promises that haven't quite been fulfilled. I do see that as a little bit different. But let's go back to Paul. I would love for you to respond just briefly here to Carl's comments about the ID movement, since you're a part.
Well, I think Carl is right in saying that that the ID movement, in fact, the very name movement implies a socio-political sort of force, got caught up in politics. And I do think there's a lot of evidence of that, that because of the breadth of these questions, they overlap science, theology, public policy, what are we going to teach in school, so forth.
Yeah.
There were a great number of activists in the late 90s and early years of the 21st century who became active mainly on the public policy side of the intelligent design movement, and the science was neglected, so that an imbalance developed between what was being said on behalf of intelligent design in front of school boards versus the hard work of doing the science of developing intelligent design as a viable theory. I lecture frequently on college and university campuses, and one of the questions I often receive from junior faculty and graduate students is, please tell us more about the theory of intelligent design, about the science behind the public movement. Because most scientists are very frightened by political activism, but they love the prospect of a successful theory teaching them something they didn't know. And I think there's now a period of correction going on in the intelligent design community, which is, I think, a much better description, to try to develop the science and make it fruitful. I think if intelligent design were only a socio-political movement, I would not be involved in it.
Yeah.
And I think Carl's right to indicate that there has been an imbalance there.
Although, to the defense of what I know of the ID community, some of the people have been very much on track doing the science, and it's people in legal groups, that have wanted to, that have encouraged, that have been looking for plaintiffs to take it to court and insert it into, and fanning the flame, local school board members that, that see parts and pieces of it that they want their schools to teach. And so it's not like the ID community has been totally in control of what's happened with their
stuff. I quite agree with you. The one of the funny things about ideas is they don't belong to anyone. Someone can read a book by Mike Behe about the notion of irreducible complexity, become very excited about that, and go straight to their school board and say, let's enable our students to talk about this.
Yeah.
And Mike Behe himself is not responsible for what that person is doing.
Yeah.
I think this reflects the great breadth of this question, mm-hmm. of where did we come from? And everyone, there's not a human being alive who does not have a passionate opinion about that, one way or another. So it's both a fascinating dimension to the design into evolution controversy of its multiple facets, and also one of the complications, and that is that you have science and politics and theology and all kinds of things all mixed up together. I'll just note historically that evolution itself was born in a similar framework. When evolutionary ideas first gained attention in Victorian England,
hey Paul,
long
yeah.
before Darwin
hey,
published.
Paul. Hey Paul, great spot for us to take a break.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're bridging into.
I'm sorry.
No, perfect. No, you're doing great.
Let's pause it right there, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Carl Giverson, author of Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution, and also with us, Paul Nelson, co-author of Explore Evolution, The Arguments for and Against Darwinism. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Yes, I have a regular job too. I'm the owner of a small chain of auto repair shops in Houston named Auto Answers, with locations in Katy, Atascocita, South Tomball, and Fall Creek. During service, we offer $9 a day rental cars without a reservation. And you can watch your car being repaired live on the internet. To make sure you're comfortable that the recommended repair is really needed, we email you digital photos showing the component on your vehicle which needs repair or replacement. And you're always invited to come under the lift with us to see with your own two eyes the cause of the concern. Visit our website at autoanswers.com. And remember, the most difficult and frustrating part of getting your vehicle serviced is doing without your primary means of transportation. And we've got you covered on that with our $9 a day rentals. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we're interviewing Carl Giberson, author of Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. And with us on the program is Paul Nelson, author of Explore Evolution, a new supplementary text to be used to teach the controversy. Subtitle, Arguments for and Against Neo-Darwinism. Gentlemen, we're so honored to have you on the program. Carl, you make a strong case in your book that intelligent design is a 19th century theory that has long been discredited by science. Maybe you could sort of summarize how that is so.
Well, Michael Behe's argument about irreducible complexity, as I read it, is really almost identical to the argument that William Paley made at the very beginning of the 1800s in a very popular textbook about natural theology. I mean, he made the famous analogy with walking across a meadow and, you know, you stub your toe on a rock and you stub your toe on a watch and, you know, of course you feel like the watch is more interesting than the rock and so the watch is too complicated to have come about through the same mechanism as the rock, so you have to postulate a watchmaker there. And while he doesn't use the terms irreducible complexity, I mean, that's an intelligent design argument that there are things in nature which we just can't explain through natural processes, so we have to invoke supernatural ones. And that is, I think, in a nutshell, the IDE argument.
Okay.
I think one of the reasons why scientists today are so uncomfortable with ID trying to re-enter science is that it took a long time and a lot of careful thought to realize that that's not a fruitful approach to understanding the natural world. And so to scientists today, it's not a new idea that they are rejecting. It's an old idea which proved itself to be useless that they don't want to re-engage.
Okay, and Paul, how would you respond?
Well, I disagree with Carl about the uselessness of design. If you think about it, there are entire sciences and parts of human inquiry that rest on making inferences to intelligence. In fact, these inferences are some of the most stable things that we know. The first person to see Stonehenge, thousands of years ago in human time, made the inference that was intelligently caused. And that inference is as true today as it was originally when it was first made. The real question is, are we going to be allowed to apply these same methods of reasoning outside of the areas where we're now comfortable with them and look at things like the origin of life or biology? But I disagree that design isn't fruitful. I think, in fact, inferences to intelligence are very fruitful, and they're scientifically testable.
Okay, now, Carl, I worked really hard. I read your book pretty much cover to cover, and on some sections went back multiple times. And I worked really hard to understand why you objected to ID from the standpoint of its usefulness. I remember in your book you wrote that ID is an inadequate theory, not only from a practical standpoint, but also from a theological standpoint. And I really read into that part about, I think I'm using the right word, a practical standpoint. And first I want to test and see if I understood what you were saying. And maybe you just said it a minute or two ago and I missed it again, but let me just see if I've got this right. What you're saying is that the history of science is really in many ways the history of, I'm actually reading your words, the history of the gradual and reluctant abandonment of intelligent design. In other words, the history of science has been mankind inserting God as the answer for unexplained phenomena, and the history of science is finding out, oops, it wasn't really God after all. There is a natural explanation. And because that's the history, because that's the reputation, the performance of that theory on a going forward basis, then we should just say, well, it keeps failing. So we really shouldn't think that way anymore. Do I have that part right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, my first, a subpart that I don't understand is this. It's also true that natural explanations have been inserted through the history of science to explain previously not understood phenomena. And these, many of these, have also failed. And even of the ones we have today, we don't know what will fail tomorrow. And so, I knew I would be asked what those examples were. And I actually, ether is one, right? A-E-T-H-E-R.
Yep.
At the early 1900s, that was the deal. Everything in time and space hung on this grid that they called ether. It's what enabled light to travel, blah, blah, blah. And the most brilliant minds in science at the time said that's the way it was. And then today, we reject that. Actually, there's a little bit of a neo-ether. There's some way of thinking being considered now that perhaps there might have been some truth in it. But anyway, it's been rejected. So why don't we then say that the scientific method itself or the naturalistic approach to science has to be rejected as an inadequate approach to solving these riddles?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, and it connects to what Paul was saying earlier about Stonehenge. And the answer is that it has to do with the type of explanations that scientists seek. The scientific community is a kind of a disorganized assortment of very eccentric and creative, brilliant individuals who get together and work on certain problems. And the enterprise is driven by the curiosity of the community. And when answers are discovered and developed that satisfy the curiosity, people say, okay, this is good. We've got this now. Let's move on to other problems. And in the satisfaction of that curiosity, a whole host of different kinds of phenomena come into play and different considerations. And when Paul suggests that the kind of explanation that we would use in the social sciences should be used in the biological sciences to explain things from physics or chemistry or biology that are puzzling, scientists are not at all satisfied with that because they're not looking for social science kinds of explanation there. They're not looking for explanations that, a person or a creature or an intelligence of some sort came in, arranged these things according to some pattern that was in their head, and then left, and this is what we find is the residue and the evidence that they were here. That's not the kind of explanation they're looking for at all. So when that's provided, it doesn't satisfy their curiosity. When you talk about things like the ether, it's the same thing, that when the explanation for ether or any number of other examples were replaced, they're always replaced with another explanation which is of the same sort. They're not replaced with a social science explanation that we're going to now abandon the idea of explaining things in terms of laws and principles and energies and so on, and instead explain them in terms of designs which are in the minds of some external creature which comes in from outside, arranges things in a particular way, and then leaves, and then we just find the fossil of what they did here. That's not the kind of explanation that they seek.
Okay,
so when that's offered, they're not interested.
Okay. Paul, help me. This is a little bit of the – I love the book, by the way, but it's a little bit of the struggle I had with the book. I just couldn't get my I couldn't really grasp what Carl was saying. What is he saying? Help me understand what he's saying, and what are your comments?
Let me see if I can express Carl's point in a way that he will agree with, although I disagree with the point he's making, and that is that in the physical sciences, and he would include biology here, acceptable explanations are rendered in terms of physical or material causes. So it's a category error or a fundamental mistake to offer an explanation that presupposes a cause that's not in the toolkit of that relevant science. Scientists have said to me, Paul, it would be like hitting the ball in baseball and running straight to third base. You're violating a fundamental rule of our discipline, that when we offer explanations, we offer them in terms of the entities and causes that we recognize as relevant for that particular science. Have I done justice to your point, Carl? I don't want to misrepresent you.
Yeah, I might not use the word material there, because that's kind of a 19th century physics term. I mean, we're not so sure that's the sort of the best paradigm for what the nature of all of these laws.
But it's non-intelligent. In other words, there's no intentionality.
Yes,
right.
That's right.
May I respond to that, though?
Yes, please.
I just received from Amazon yesterday a book by Jerry Coyne, who I know. We see each other from time to time at the University of Chicago, and we've been on television together. And interestingly, Jerry just reviewed a book of Carl's. Maybe we'll come to that later, the very book we're talking about today, in fact. But Jerry Coyne's book is called Why Evolution is True, just published from Viking. And Coyne says in the book, we know evolution is true because we know that intelligent design is false. And he gives example after example of biological patterns that he says cannot be reconciled with an intelligent designer. Now, that is using the notion of intelligent design in the scientific context to derive particular predictions. Jerry Coyne, for instance, looks at a nerve that in human beings runs in a very funny way. It innervates our larynx, and it's called the recurrent laryngeal nerve. And he said, why would a designer do it like that? That's a very odd way to build human beings. It's not what I would expect if life had been designed by a beneficent intelligence. Ergo, evolution by natural selection is true. This is a central theme of his book, and it's a central theme of evolutionary reasoning. Now, if evolutionary biologists can use the notion of intelligent design in scientific contexts in a way that they think falsifies the theory, yes, then I think we ought to be able to open up that question for debate. If intelligent design can be used by Jerry Coyne in that way in a scientific setting, it seems to me he's already violated the rule that Carl says obtains for biology.
Well, I mean, I would say that's not what Jerry Coyne is doing. I mean, Jerry Coyne is not explaining something by saying an intelligent designer did this. He's talking about intelligent design in this case because he knows that he's writing for a vast readership that has this deep-seated intuition that the world is so remarkable around us that surely there has to be intelligence all over the place. And when he's writing for those readers, he has to explain to them, making a point which has been made by many evolutionists, that the world is so filled with what looks like sort of cobbled together ad hoc designs that to suppose that it's all the product of creative acts of a supernatural deity is to make a mockery out of the whole concept of supernatural.
But how can the evidence for a theory be contingent on the preconceptions of the audience? Surely if Einstein was making a case for relativity to, let's say, brilliant extraterrestrials, he wouldn't begin by describing what human beings are. I mean, it seems to be very odd that the evidence for a scientific theory should depend on the erroneous preconceptions of an audience. It seems to me to be very strange. I mean, that is imparting a cultural context I don't think is actually scientific. Do you see my point? I mean, why should the misconceptions of an audience have any bearing at all on the scientific case that one makes for a theory?
Okay, I'm gonna stop us here. I hope it's in a fair place, really, just because we need to take a break. All of this is interesting. I have a sense that another 45 seconds won't resolve it.
Yes.
So we're gonna take a break. This is Rick Davis and Lael Arrington. We're interviewing Carl Giberson. The main subject of this interview is his brand new book called Saving Darwin, and we have Paul Nelson with us, also an expert in this area of evolution, more of an intelligent design viewpoint, recently published book of which he's co-author, Explore Evolution. So we'll continue after the break. Private parties, wedding receptions, business meetings. Main Street Crossing in Tomball is an awesome place to hold these events. Most advertisements are full of exaggeration, but this one is not. If there was a word that communicated better than the word unique, we'd use it. But we can't think of a better word. So if you go to MainStreetCrossing.com, you'll see for yourself that your friends and family will be wowed if you book your events there. This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off because we have three ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes. So without any effort, you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. Three ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most. We're interviewing Carl Giberson and Paul Nelson, and the topic today is evolution and intelligent design. And Carl, one other thing that I want to ask you about it that I really worked hard on in the book is that, you know, I know that you believe in God, and you make statements, many statements through the book about when and where you think God did not play a role in the creation of life and even the universe itself. But after searching for quite some time, I couldn't find where you outline the role that you believe God did play in the creation of everything. So I thought perhaps you could explain that.
Well, that's a philosophically and theologically very complicated question. Let me start by maybe making an analogy that's kind of timely. We have a new president that has inaugurated a sweeping set of changes designed to make the economy become stronger. Now, if we are to watch the various things that happen as a consequence of these new policies, we're going to notice all kinds of things happening. Some family somewhere will go down the street and they'll buy a new car, and some other family will buy a TV, and somebody will get a job, and so on. Now, what's the relationship between Barack Obama's decisions that he made about what he wants to do with the economy and those individual actions of those people? I mean, it's very hard to kind of tie them together in a simple way. So in the same sense, I think that it's very difficult to look at the creator of the universe, who's responsible for all the laws and everything that we have working here, and then bring that sense of causality into individual particularities and say, oh, well, like, here's a mutation that God did, or here's some little process that God has installed, or here's the asteroid that made the dinosaurs go extinct that was sent by God. I mean, we can't really work it at that level. I think what we have to do is we have to recognize that all of creation is God's, and so in a certain sense, there's nothing happening anywhere that's not a part of the unfolding creative work of God. And then it's through the eyes of faith, I think, that we have to look at this process and say that this is a rather extraordinary universe that we live in, and look at all the extraordinary things which have appeared in this universe, from human beings to sunsets to galaxies, and we can sit in awe of these things and praise God for the fact that they exist there. But I think to try and locate God's activity in some specific physical processes is just not realistic to do. And I think it's also theologically dangerous to do that, because as soon as you start locating God in specific places, and you have to say, well, what about these other places where you're not locating God? So I think we're always safest theologically to let God be responsible for the whole show, and not merely the origination of the whole show, but the ongoing maintenance and support and superintendence of the entire unfolding of the cosmos, and see it all as one big creation. So in that sense, I would say I locate God's creative work everywhere.
Everywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, here I have two follow-up questions. I'm not even sure which order to take them in. But one is, let's go to the bigger overarching one. If there, and you write, you do such a great job in your book of documenting that there is so much disagreement within the scientific community on how evolution works. You've got major voices in major disagreement. And so, you know, given what you just said, and the fact that there's so much disagreement about how evolution works, then how can you be so sure that the process is is so natural in its outpouring, and that it can be accounted for by natural forces?
Well, the disagreements are not so much individuals who think that the other person is simply wrong about things. The disagreements are about the relative significance of various processes at work. That at some level, we have randomness that occurs in nature. At another level, nature is selective.
Okay, wait. Let's just back up. At some level, there's randomness. Okay, if you're not exactly sure of the process and there are so many gaps, how can you be sure that some processes are entirely natural and that and I think you expressed it in your book as saying, you know, we don't limit the creative work of God. Perhaps the unfolding history includes a steady infusion of divine creativity under the scientific radar. So how can you be sure that anything is purely natural?
Well, until we find compelling evidence to be saying here directly on the scientific radar, we have evidence for the supernatural, it behooves the scientists to not be invoking that. I mean, we don't find that on the scientific radar. We find the occasional thing here or there that we can't completely explain, but the history of science is that we eventually come up with explanations for those things. So keeping God around to explain these little gaps in our knowledge has not proven to be helpful. So I don't think it makes sense to suppose that just because we don't have a full agreement as to how this works, therefore we should allow for the possibility of some entirely different category of explanation. When we talk about disagreements in the scientific community, they're relatively minor disagreements, but they're all disagreements that are in the same arena. That some people think that something called convergence is a big deal in evolution, that evolution sort of has directions that are built in. And other people dispute the significance of that. Some people think that group selection is important. Others think that it's not important. But in all of these cases, they're talking about natural explanations, and they're trying to evaluate the relative significance of them in explaining the overall development of life on the planet. No cases are these disagreements about whether we should invoke natural explanations or not.
Okay, but then you may have, I mean, it's possible, and ideas making the case that these objections are not made because of some sort of a priori philosophical commitment. Paul, how would you respond to to that question? If you can't be sure about how evolution is naturally explained, then how can you be sure that God is not a part of it? How would you respond? Or how would you respond to what Carl said?
Yeah, I think this is a point where Carl and I have a fundamental disagreement. I think, first of all, there is there's something very misleading in the adjective supernatural. Take what we're doing right now, having a conversation about these very interesting questions. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's not spooky or mysterious in any way, mm-hmm. but the explanation of this event, of this conversation, of the real patterns that we're generating in nature, going out eventually as sound waves from radios, could not be explained without reference to at least four agents. The two of you and Carl and myself, We are unique causes where we cannot be reduced to physics, we can't be reduced to chemistry, we can't even be reduced to our physiology. The things that we produce as agents are explained by reference to our agency, our intelligence. And I do think that science uses intelligence as a causal category all the time. These hypotheses are tested. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't, but there's nothing spooky or mysterious about the category of intelligence. So I just
in the social sciences.
Carl, what about metallurgy, failures on bridges, forensic science, archaeology? Aren't there places within science itself that point to the intelligence agency? The intelligence agency?
Yes, but archaeology is a social science. I mean, it's a study of the behaviors of people in the past.
Okay, well, let's just take forensic science then. Oh, well, go ahead.
There are human beings now have the power to manipulate organisms in a way that it would have made David Hume's head spin or even Charles Darwin's head spin. You can genetically engineer rabbits to glow in the dark. Now, if you gave a glow-in-the-dark rabbit to, let's say, an alien and said, explain this funny feature of this rabbit, he would make a mistake if he inferred that that had a natural, non-intentional, non-mental cause. So I think it's simply not true that the category of intelligence is limited only to things that are in the social sciences. In fact, you can find intelligence invoked wherever the evidence requires it. The only place where it isn't, interestingly, is where the metaphysical temperature begins to go up, namely in cosmology and historical biology, because there the agent that may be implicated has theological connotations. And I think that's a very inconsistent rule, excluding intelligence just where the metaphysical temperature begins to rise.
Well,
I'd have to respond to that and say
okay.
That there's a clear distinction that's been kind of hammered out, I think, with great clarity between the social sciences, where the kind of causality that Paul is referring to is invoked regularly and helpfully and appropriately, and so on, and in physics and chemistry and biology, it's not invoked there. And when the intelligence is invoked in the social sciences, the intelligence that we're talking about is a fellow human intelligence. It's an intelligence that we are familiar with, that we can study, we can do experiments in the social sciences and so on. And the analogy, I think, is just very, very weak to say that there's something similar to invoking human agency in the social sciences and invoking divine agency in physics. I mean, I don't think that's a good analogy at all.
Well, we've only got a minute and a half left. Carl, what kind of challenge would you want to give people to invite them to explore your book and some things to maybe chew on and wrestle with?
Well, I'd like for people to set aside for the moment the possibility that maybe the pundits who've told them that evolution is in competition with their faith might be wrong. Just to set that aside and to read Saving Darwin and see whether or not they might say, gee, if evolution is described like this, I can believe that this is God's creative process, because evolution can be awe-inspiring and wonderful and beautiful and mysterious and so on, and it has everything that we need to be a real creation story for Christians.
Thank you very much.
All right. Great interview. We're going to do it again.
Yeah.
Right, Leo?
We'll be back next week, and maybe we can kind of weave some of these themes back in. We'll look forward to having you both back next week when we'll focus on Paul Nelson's book, Explore Evolution, The Arguments for and Against Neo-Darwinism. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on with us twice.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
This is Leah Larrington and Rick Davis on The Things That Matter Most. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. We're always interested in making our show better, and you, our listeners, can play a role. We'd like your feedback on what you like about our show and what you think can be better. You can give us your insights by going to thethingsthatmattermost.org or by sending us an email at info@thethingsthatmattermost.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we've been celebrating Darwin Day, February
12th. Yes.
By educating the public on science. That's what it's all about. And so we've had this great discussion between two scientists, Paul Nelson, Carl Giberson, on Giberson's book, Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. What did you think?
Well, I mean, I'm confused. I feel very similar to how I felt when I was reading the book. I referenced in the interview, I went back several times to try to pull out. I mean, I really feel like I was trying to understand Carl.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing I don't, the part I don't get is if I believe in God and I believe God is the creator, and then I look at all of creation, and then I say, you must not detect any intelligence behind what's been created. I'm going to keep working on it when we get in the next interview, but I don't get that. How about you?
Yeah, well, I thought it was very interesting because Carl is a follower of Christ. And, you know, we don't just have the Old Testament books that stand alone. We have a reader of the Old Testament books that, you know, that gives us an additional perspective on them. And it means a lot to me as a follower of Christ that Christ would say, you know, it's going to be, you know, in the future as it was in the days of Noah when people were marrying and getting married and referring to it in a very historical way. Or when the Pharisees ask him, can we get divorced? And they're talking about permission for divorce. And he goes back and says, well, you know, in the beginning, let's see, I wrote it down here somewhere. He says, have you not read, so that's going to be referring to those scrolls of Genesis that are in all those synagogues, have you not read that he created them from the beginning, made them female, and said, therefore, a man shall leave his mother and father, and hold or father and mother, and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So here's Jesus weighing in on a very, very important question. The issue of divorce, I mean, cuts right to the heart of all of our lives. You know, in these, you know, all of us, everyone is, you know, face difficult moments in a marriage. And he's referring back to this passage from the Bible. And so to me, he's elevating it. Okay, well, there's two issues there. There's the reality of God said it in a historical context, and there's the meaning of what God said. Well, I don't understand how you get meaning from that if it didn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm, as a follower of Christ, I have to go back and give some reality back there, even if it's not the, even if Genesis is not the same historical validity as, you know, an object, you know, a historian of science, mm-hmm. writing a historian of science. Maybe it's approached a different way, but I still have to think, how can you derive meaning from non-reality?
Mm-hmm.
I don't get that. So,
well, we're going to go
at it. I'm confused too.
We're going to go at it again next week with these same gentlemen. We're going to turn things around. And focus more on Paul Nelson's book with comments by Carl Giberson. But that's it for today. That wraps up another show. Going into another very busy week where we all have lots of things to keep our minds entirely occupied. But it's the kinds of questions that we ask on this show that in the end are going to be the most important. So let's not get so busy this week that we don't take time to think about the things that matter most.